king saw Darius's son-in-law, Mithridates, riding out far in front of the others and bringing a body of cavalry with him. He charged ahead and knocked Mithridates off his horse with a thrust in his face. A Persian nobleman brought down his axe with all his strength upon Alexander's head. He sheared off part of Alexander's helmet and one of its plumes, but failed to wound him. Alexander knocked him off his horse and drove his lance into his chest. Meanwhile, another of Darius's sons-in-law had raised his scimitar against Alexander from behind. But Cletus, the grizzled commander of the royal squadron, sliced off the Persian's arm with a single swipe of his sword. Alexander only avoided death by one man's fast reaction.
And if it weren't for that man's fast reaction, history would have been drastically different. This, of course, is a paragraph about Alexander the Great from Anthony Everett's fantastic book about Alexander. He would go on to win that battle. He would also go on to defeat the Persians and conquer a huge portion of the known world. He would go down not just as the greatest Greek conqueror, but one of the greatest conquerors of all time. This is the So We Speak podcast. This is Cole Fakes, and I'm joined by Terry Fakes. We are doing our empire series, and we've arrived at the founding of the Western empires, Greece, and next week, Rome. We've done a survey of what we would now consider Eastern empires. We've done Assyria, we've done Babylon, we've done Persia, and there's a fundamental shift this week, not just in geography, but in style, in culture, and in the world that enters the New Testament. We've been talking about Old Testament empires. This Greek empire is going to span the Old Testament and the New Testament. So when we were doing our research for this, Greece was one of the ones I was looking forward to. I've always loved ancient Greece and Rome. In fact, if OSU had had a classics major, I would have been a classics major in college, but they didn't. So I had to settle for math instead, also invented by the Greeks, and add on philosophy, also invented by the Greeks. And it's always been I've always had a special love for the Greeks, but one of the things that's an interesting overlap is sitting here talking about our research and the Greeks. Every seminarian is going to learn Greek because it's the language of the New Testament. And so as we're getting into the Greek Empire, we're turning the page into the New Testament, the time of Jesus, and you cannot understand the New Testament unless you understand the Greeks. So our task is huge. The Greek, we say Greek civilization, and like some of our other empires, you mean several different civilizations over several thousands of years. But we're going to try and do a high overview of the Greek empires through the ages and set up the connections with the Bible that appear in several interesting places, maybe the most interesting of which is actually in between the two Testaments.
Exactly. And you know, the opening quote comes from a battle between Alexander and Darius, the last of the Persian kings, about 324 BC. But what a lot of people don't know is long before the Greeks burst on the scene, they had been around culturally and politically as a people group for quite a long time. In fact, I think I'd probably go back to the Mycenaean period, where you begin to see what we can recognize as distinctly Greek culture. And that goes all the way back to 1600 BC. And then as you move forward in time, it seems like the locus of Greek civilization moves to the mainland. And you begin to hear about Athens, you begin to hear about the Greek cities that we know of now. And one of the most prominent figures in Greek culture, Greek history, and Greek literature, the blind poet Homer.
Well, if you think about Greek culture, chances are you're going to think about Homer eventually. It's the most famous fountainhead text, not just of Greek culture, but of Western civilization. So if you start a Western Civ course, one of the first texts you're going to read, if it's a good Western Civ course, is the Iliad, or if it's an even better course and more entertaining, you'll read the Odyssey, which is much easier to read than the Iliad. But the Iliad is the fountainhead of Western civilization, and it's also the fountainhead of Greek values. And there's a lot you can learn about the world BC by reading the Iliad. It's a world of warriors and honor. It's a world of brutality. It's a world of myth and legend. And of course, in the Iliad, you have Achilles, who is the greatest warrior in Greece, and his story. In fact, the Iliad begins talking about the wrath of Achilles. And the poem, it's an epic poem, is an exploration of this wrath. And this is central to the culture of the Mycenaean period. The Iliad and the Odyssey are set sometime within the 12th, 13th century BC, right in the middle of this Mycenaean period. Of course, you have the Greeks and the Trojans. You have Helen of Troy, who has been taken, and you have the face that launches a thousand ships. Agamemnon and his little brother Menelaus, who was married to Helen, are going back to win their estranged wife back from the Trojans. She's been stolen by Paris. If you've seen the movie Troy, which for all of its historical inaccuracies is a fantastic movie, you know that Orlando Bloom steals Helen, and Agamemnon and little brother Menelaus launch their ships and besiege the city of Troy for 10 years. The Iliad starts at the end of this war, but it models the high culture and mythic culture of Greek warfare. And though it's written to describe a period of the 12th and 13th centuries, it probably comes into its written form in the 8th century or 9th century by a poet named Homer. And there's a million disputes about the Odyssey. For a while, people thought that Troy didn't exist, until you had a really fascinating archaeologist named Schliemann who found historic Troy. He actually dug through the layer of Troy that probably is the Trojan War, because he thought it was a little bit older than it was. There's all kinds of great stories with this, but there's a lot of controversy about Homer as well. One of my favorite things that somebody said about Homer, this is attributed to G.K. Chesterton, and it certainly fits him, but I don't know if it's actually true. He said, you know, people used to think that the Iliad was written by Homer, but of course now we know it was written by another blind poet who lived at the exact same time, who was also named Homer. And the controversy is, it's a poem that comes into the written context sometime after it's composed. And it describes a mythic era of Greece. And so people are going back and forth on whether or not this happened. And for our purposes, whether or not it did happen, the story captures the culture of ancient Greece. They are a warlike people, rich, high culture, heroism, and gods mixed into everything. And they have a lost age of bravery and wonder that's captured in the Trojan War.
That's so true, Cole. And all the way back in that time period, you're going to see the cultural values all the way down to and beyond Alexander the Great, as much as 500 years later. You know, for us, if I were to say the word chivalry, we would probably all conjure up pictures in our mind of King Arthur and the knights and their values and their you know, just their politeness and what was right and what was wrong. Well, Homer captures the chivalry, if you will, of Greek culture, their interaction with the gods and how they make sense of the randomness of life, what they value, honor and strength. And, you know, you just capture that. And then when we fast forward a little bit, you're going to see those ideas come all the way to us through the conqueror Alexander. But it's not just culture, is it? Because if we fast forward just a little bit after defeat, you know, of the final defeat of, or before the final defeat of the Persian Empire, you have this flowering, not just of culture, but of philosophy and science, and I would even say a little bit technology in the 5th century. And those also are some of the names that we know best from ancient Greece.
If you fast forward from the end of the Odyssey a couple hundred years, you get into what you're describing, which is the classical period, the classical age of ancient Greece. This is where most of what we know about Greece, the democracy, the culture, the art, the philosophy, comes into play. And this is also the period where we intersect back up with our story of the Persian Empire. So the Greek Empire wasn't really an empire in the beginning. In fact, it was unlike any of the other empires that we've discussed in that it was a loose network of city-states who all had some common features, and they had some differences. And even before the Persian Wars, you have a great civil war between the Greeks, between Athens and Sparta. But they coalesce against a common enemy when they're challenged by, in the east by the Persians. And the Athenians and the Spartans are the two major cities who provide the leadership, they provide the strategy, and eventually, through the brave exploits of the 300 Spartans at Thermopylae, through the Athenian navy, the battles of Salamis and Plataea, they repel and defeat the Persian armies. And after this, you have flourishing, especially in the city of Athens, in a way that is really unseen before and unseen again until maybe the High Renaissance or the scientific revolution of our more modern era. You have artists and philosophers. You have Socrates, Plato, Aristotle. You have playwrights like Sophocles and Aristophanes. You have statesmen like Pericles and orators. Right. You have the Senate in the proto-democratic for the people, of the people, by the people, and for the people way of governing in Athens. And then you have all over the Greek world a flourishing of culture and language, thinking and art. And when we think back on the classical Greek period, this is the period we think about. This is where the famous names and the things that you read in school all come from, is about 130 years in the classical era of Greek civilization. What's interesting, though, is it's still not really an empire until you get into the mid-4th century when you have a figure named Philip of Macedon. He is essentially a military innovator. He is able to create a way of doing war that provides a leg up on everybody else. And this is what we would call the Macedonian phalanx and the use of siege engines. So he comes along and he is able to exercise a significant advantage over anybody he's fighting against. And when that happens in history, what you almost always see is the making of an empire. When you have a military or technological advantage that sets one group apart from the others, you should expect that the world is about to coalesce behind this great military leader. And that's exactly what starts to happen with Philip of Macedon.
Now, that's right. He does innovate, and probably the inheritor of that innovation is his son, will greatly eclipse him in terms of taking that and then having the zeal to spread it throughout the world.
Yes, his son Alexander is far and away the greatest military and cultural leader of the ancient world. There was nothing quite like what Alexander did, not just to conquer the world, of which he would have been known for ages and ages, but to spread the culture of Greece across the world. So one of the words that's used to describe this is Hellenization. It comes from Hellas, which is a word that often describes the Greeks. Hellenization was basically the influence of Greek language and culture and rules, customs that spread across the whole known world. And before the end of Alexander's life, he was virtually undefeated in battle and just kept conquering and conquering and conquering until finally he dies in Babylon. The story of his whole life is everywhere his army went, they took the Greek culture with them. So they, like the Assyrian Empire, were essentially trying to subsume these other empires under their cultural heading. They wanted the whole world to be infiltrated and in some ways covered up by Greek culture.
You know, one of the things about Alexander is a lot of biographers talk about his military expertise, and he certainly had that. But one of the things I think is important to know about him is, as a warrior, he was looking back to the Iliad and the Odyssey for the idealism of that. You know, it's said that he slept with a copy of the Iliad under his pillow, and I don't know if that's true, but it certainly captures the ideal. But Cole, another thing that's that I think may be influential, and I'd like to know what your thought is the chain of teacher and student is Socrates and his great student Plato and his most famous student Aristotle. And until Alexander was 16 years old, Aristotle was his tutor. And so he wasn't just a military man,
Philip of Macedon, one of the brilliant things that he did was he wanted the best education for his son and heir, Alexander. And so as he's conquering some of these Greek city-states, he realizes that if he's going to have the kind of warrior, philosopher, conqueror son that he wants, he needs to go find somebody who can tutor him and train him. And of course, there's nobody greater in the world than Aristotle. And so you actually have a legacy of this in the Greco-Roman Empire of these philosopher kings. Of course, Plato, who's Aristotle's teacher, writes about these philosopher kings in Plato's Republic, that this is the kind of person who should govern, not just someone who's skilled at war, but someone who's skilled in philosophy and someone who can think and reason and work for the common good, justice and equality. And you have a blending of martial virtues, bravery and courage and justice, with civic virtues of temperance and prudence. Alexander certainly embodied these. I don't know that he was consistent in every way with what Aristotle taught him, but he did embody that. And that's part of the respectability of Greek culture. So in the same way that we talked about, Babylon had a more potent culture. Assyria spread it everywhere, but Assyria really wanted to be like Babylon. Mm-hmm. Greek and Rome were that way. The Romans were a mightier empire militarily, and it lasted a lot longer than the fragile coalition of the Greek empire. However, the Romans really wanted to be seen as the heirs of Greece. They adopted the same pantheon. They adopted very similar artwork, culture, city building, governance. A lot of those things draw from Greece. Greece has this high and enlightened, potent culture that spreads across the world. And some of this is because of the Iliad and the Odyssey, these values, the way that they worshiped, the way that they behaved, the way that they saw themselves. And much of it had to do with the way that Alexander propagated that culture. He was someone who was more than just a warring brute. He was an enlightened leader and ruler of his people. And there's a long tradition of that in ancient Greece.
Absolutely. I think that's what really comes down to us, because although Alexander's empire went all the way to the east, to India, I mean, he conquered, he was basically at the border of China when he turned back, gets sick, and dies at the age of 33. But he had conquered so much, and that would be notable. But what, if you think about it, though, it's not the Persians, despite their kingdom that we remember, or the Babylonians or the Assyrians. The long-lasting influence came from the Greeks, because they had more than just martial prowess. They were also trying to spread what they saw and what they thought as a superior culture. You can often tell how people think about themselves. And one of the ways to know this about the Greeks is the Greeks divided the world into two classes. There were Greeks and barbarians. And the word barbarian comes from bar. In other words, the people that don't even make sense when they talk. In other words, they really have this superiority complex around their culture, and they were successful at spreading it, and we're the inheritors of that.
This provides our first big intersection between the Bible and the Greek culture, the Greek empire. The book of Daniel prophesies the Greeks in several different chapters. If you'll remember when we talked about Assyria and Babylon, Daniel is living in these empires. And he talks about, in his interpretation of Nebuchadnezzar's dream, he talks about the succession of empires that will pass through the next couple hundred years, with Babylon being the golden head, and then being conquered and conquered and conquered until you get these iron but clay feet that are smashed by a great stone that's not cut with human hands. The Greeks would be the second to last of this group. So they would be the bronze, and they would be the ones who are going to give rise to the Romans, in which the stone strikes. And of course, that's Jesus Christ. But there's another prophecy in Daniel, Daniel chapter 11, that applies to Alexander the Great. In Daniel 11, he's prophesying in the reign of Darius, and he stands up and prophesies and says, "Now I will show you the truth. Behold, three more kings shall arise in Persia, and a fourth shall be richer than all of them. And when he has become strong through his riches, he shall stir up all against the kingdom of Greece." Then a mighty king shall arise who shall rule with great dominion and do as he wills. And as soon as he has arisen, his kingdom shall be broken and divided toward the four winds of heaven, but not to his posterity, nor according to the authority with which he ruled. For his kingdom shall be plucked up and go to others beside these. Kind of a cryptic prophecy about Alexander and his life, but it matches exactly with what happens in history.
That's exactly right. It is amazing that Alexander dies, one would say prematurely, at age 33. He'd made no provisions whatsoever for a successor. I mean, who's thinking about that at the age of 33 when you're at the top of the world and most successful? And so what happened after his death in 323 BC, he has this huge kingdom. And as you might expect, he has a handful of powerful generals who control large areas of troops and large areas of territory. And so for the next 40 years or so, there's just a lot of chaos as these generals fight each other to try to be the new Alexander. And the way it settles is basically into four areas. The kingdom gets carved up into four, but for our purposes, I just want to talk about three, because there were three significant generals. One of the general's name was Ptolemy, P-T-O-L-E-M-Y, and he had Egypt and what we now know as Israel. There was Seleucus, who had Syria and the area north of Israel, and then Antigonus, who doesn't figure into the biblical story as much, so I'll just mention him and go on. But the Seleucus founds a dynasty, meaning his son ruled after him and his son ruled after him, and so did Ptolemy. You get these Ptolemaic rulers, or the Ptolemies. His son ruled, and then his son ruled. And so you get these two dynasties, and they come into biblical history very much so, because the time between the Testaments, between the Old Testament in 400 BC and the coming of Christ, some very formative things happen. Basically, the Seleucid kings, the descendants of Seleucus, proved to be a little more militarily powerful than the Ptolemies in Egypt. And so in the middle of the second century BC, so now we're moving on 100 years after Alexander and sorting all this out, 100 years later, one of the descendants of Seleucus is ruling not only Syria and big portions of Babylon, but also what we now know as the land of Israel. And he comes into our story in a fairly significant way.
So this dynasty named they're called the Antiochians after their successive names, becomes the dominant ruling party in our story in Israel. And Antiochus Epiphanes, who's Antiochus IV, is really quite the character. And he names himself Antiochus Epiphanes to essentially claim that he is a god made manifest on the earth. And so you get a sense of what this guy's like to be around. And he is very much of the mindset that everyone under him is going to worship his gods. And so what he does is he begins to impose his religion on all peoples, including the Jews. And so he forbids the worship of Yahweh by penalty of death. In order to put his finger in the wound, he goes to the temple of Jerusalem, destroys it, and puts a temple of Zeus, or he puts an altar to Zeus in the Jerusalem temple. And what's interesting about this is the way that he conducts himself in Jerusalem actually, many people believe, fulfills another prophecy about what's going to happen in between the time of rebuilding in Jerusalem and the time of the Messiah.
Exactly. You get this prophecy of, and I think probably what you're thinking about is the abomination that causes desolation in Daniel, and the idea that whereas Alexander was known for spreading Greek culture through the power of the culture. Obviously, he was a military person, but he didn't say, you're going to become Greek or you're going to die. He basically let the power of the Greek culture do it. 100 years later, Antiochus is a much, much weaker ruler. And so he comes in and by setting up this temple to Zeus and then forcing the Jews to either eat pork or make a sacrifice to another god at the pain of death, he is just an abomination to God. And the prophecy was that this would happen. And Antiochus is the one who I think a lot of people think he is the fulfillment, or at least the first fulfillment of that prophecy in Daniel chapter 11.
And people take that to be a preview of the Antichrist, because Jesus also right. talks about the abomination of desolation. And whether that has happened, whether it's a model, whether it happens in the first century, whether it happens again at the end of the age, in the end times, the Antichrist, we've talked about this some in our Revelation series that we did last year. But he certainly serves as a model for a king who sets themselves up against God in the style of Nebuchadnezzar or Sennacherib or some of these other conquerors. Mm-hmm. Well, this what he does in Jerusalem stirs up a family called the Maccabees. And Judas Maccabeus rises up and they kill an official messenger of Antiochus Epiphanes. And when the word gets back that this has happened, he sends a group of people to kill them. They rise up, they ambush them, they kill them again. And now they've got a full-fledged war on their hands. And what happens is Judah Maccabee is a pretty formidable military leader. In fact, right. he takes back most of the area of Judea. He takes back parts of Jerusalem. And for the next century, this family, through some succession in their own brotherhood, but then afterwards their sons, they do several interesting things. They rule themselves essentially as a new Judean kingly, priestly family. They unite the priesthood with the kingship in ways that are going to preview a little bit of what happens with Jesus being a prophet, priest, and a king. They're mm-hmm. also going to declare themselves a new promised family of God's provision by throwing off the Greeks and living in the promised land once again. They are going to set up many of the foundational pillars of society that you're going to see in the New Testament as well. So you're going to see different sects start to form, some of them in line with the Maccabees, some of them in protest with the Maccabees. You're going to see the Pharisees and the Sadducees and the forebearers of these players in the New Testament. Even Herod's family, where Herod's family comes from, is going to originate to this period. And so this sets the stage for much of what we know in the first century when Jesus is born and lives in Judea.
That's a great point. From the time that Alexander conquers this whole area in about 332, I believe, is when he conquers, just to give us some time frames here for Israel, until about 165. So think about that, 332 to 165, well over 100 years of rule. Antiochus IV is the last Greek ruler of Israel because of this successful rebellion. And several things that you and I know come from this. One is, when we think of the Jews 160 years later, when Jesus comes, thinking a Messiah is going to be a military commander. Well, they had just seen the Maccabees overthrow a powerful empire, the Greek Empire, and kick them out. And so you start to realize, okay, maybe it's not so unreasonable as to why they were thinking that or where that came from. Of course, the festival of Hanukkah comes from this. When Judah and the Maccabees conquered Jerusalem and kicked them out, they go into the temple, they're going to start the lights, and it has to be certain kind of olive oil, and they only have enough to last for one day. And while they purify others, and it miraculously lasts, for 8 days. And so you get this festival of lights, and Hanukkah comes from that, quote, miraculous event. Now, this isn't in your Bible. This is in that period between the Old Testament and the New Testament. But in the Apocrypha, you'll have the books of 1st and 2nd Maccabees. And then there are two others, 3rd and 4th, that as historical books purport to describe the persecution and the revolt and the success of the revolt. But the idea of having an independent Jewish kingdom from about 165 until the Romans show up, around 100 years later, really sets a bit of the messianic fervor, if you will, when Jesus comes. If you think about the idea that there were many people claiming to be the Messiah, and you might ask yourself why, well, just 100 years before, they had successfully thrown off the Greeks. So a lot of things that happen here in between the Old and New Testament really do set the stage. Alexander in the Greek language, the Greek culture, the oppression ultimately by Antiochus, the successful revolt, all these things really add a lot of context to the New Testament.
The historical interface with the Greeks ends in this period in Israel. There will not be Greek rule again. And as you mentioned, there will be about 100 years before the Romans come in and assert their dominance over the region. And of course, that's the world that Jesus is born into. But the influence of Greek culture doesn't end in this period. In fact, if we leave our historical timeline and we pick it up next week, the cultural timeline extends into the New Testament. In fact, most of the New Testament is heavily influenced by the Greek culture that is still prevalent in Judea. And of course, Paul in Romans says that God sent his son Jesus at just the right time. And there's a lot of discussion about what this means and exactly what he's referring to. But one of the components has to be the influence and the prevalence of Greek culture. If you have the peace of Rome and the Roman roads and all of that,
right,
you also have the culture of Greece, the language and the familiarity of the culture across the known world. And if you think about your New Testament, Paul's missionary journeys are essentially into the heart of Greek culture. These cities that Paul goes to, especially these big cities like Corinth and Athens and Ephesus, while some of them are in Greece and some of them are in modern-day Turkey, these are the influential cities of Greek culture in the world. And what Paul's method was to go into these places that were essentially the equivalents of New York and London and LA in their era, and set up shop there and know that when people became Christians and learned under his teaching, they would go back to where they lived and they would spread the message there. And there's a lot of New Testament scholarship about Paul's methods, what he was doing. There's some that have argued that Paul is essentially setting up schools exactly like Plato and Socrates and Aristotle had in Athens, and that he was training disciples as a philosopher, imparting his teaching and his wisdom to his students. The other big thing is, as the gospel spreads throughout the Greek world, it comes into contact with Greek religion and philosophy, and that is seen nowhere better than in Acts 17, when Paul gets invited to speak to the philosophers in Athens. You know, if you go back to the classical period, the hub in the world of philosophy and thinking and enlightenment was in Athens at the Areopagus on Mars Hill. This is where the philosophers would gather. And as Luke tells us in Acts chapter 17, they would discuss new things that they had heard and new philosophies and new ideas. And Paul enters into this mix. He stands up on Mars Hill and the ideas of Christianity come into play up against the philosophical traditions reaching all the way back to the time of Homer, the idols, the unknown idol that Paul picks out. He introduces something that was a total anathema to the Greeks, that a man would die and rise from the dead as the Son of God.
That's really a nice bow on that, because you do see Paul going back to the dominant culture of his time and presenting the gospel. But you know, something that I've noticed in your teaching, Cole, that you talk about a lot, and I really appreciate this, and I will probably copy it and not give you credit, by the way, but you talk a lot about the way God prefers to work in the Bible, his method of operation. And God has ways he likes to do things. And one of the threads that's running through this Empire series that illustrates that to me is, you have the Assyrians who, you know, conquer Israel, and they try to conquer Judah. And then in the book of Habakkuk, you get God saying, I'm going to rise up the Babylonians, and they're not godly people, but they're going to serve my purpose. And they're going to you know, they're going to judge the Assyrians, if you will. And so then you get the Babylonians taking these captives, and Israel goes into captivity. And while the Babylonians thought that that was just them being really good conquerors, it actually fit God's plan that he had prophesied. You'll go into that, and I will bring you back. Then God used the Persians. Of course, the Persians didn't know they were being used in God's plan. They were just conquering people. But they conquered Babylon and fulfilled God's plan by letting the Jews go back. Now here come the Greeks, and they conquer, and what do? They basically give a ubiquitous language and culture that God is going to use to further his plans. And so what I'm trying to say is, every step in this path, you see that God seems to have a method of operation. He uses the forces of the world, even the godless forces of the world. Nobody's going to argue these were righteous kingdoms, but he likes to work through these kingdoms to accomplish his purposes. And it seems like, as you said, he's preparing the New Testament with the Greek culture. Here he is again with his unique method of operation.
That's exactly right. And you can see this in hindsight, but you have to remember that the people who were living through this, the Daniels of the world, the Nehemiahs, the right. Maccabees, they didn't get to see this. They had to trust God and take his word for the fact that he was going to use this empire and this situation for his purposes and to bring about his mm-hmm. promises. And God used many, many, many influential and uninfluential people during this period, not just to preserve the line of Christ, although that's definitely true, but to preserve his people for the coming of Christ. And the Greek Empire is the cultural seedbed of the church. In fact, Greek thinking and Greek philosophy and Christian theology are in some ways inseparable. It's the world into which Christ began to teach and his disciples began to spread the gospel across the world. And so we have the Greek Empire not just as a pagan conquering nation, but as a formative influence in the way the gospel comes and spreads across the world and the ways that we know it today.
And you know, one of the things, Cole, that hits me, I'll just give you one little example that I know that you're aware of, but it's almost like Athens as the symbol of Greek culture, because it was probably the most famous and most influential, casts a little bit of a shadow into the New Testament. It's brilliant the way God used Greek ideas and repurposed them to explain the gospel to people. In other words, if you're going to explain something to me, I have to have some reference. You have to know my language, so to speak, and use an analogy that I at least understand. One of the things that the Greeks did was they had a common language, common analogies. And here's one simple little example. The word for church in the New Testament is ekklesia. That's a Greek word, and it didn't mean church. But it was well known in the Greek world as that is the assembly of people who came together to vote, make laws. It was basically an assembly of people who were citizens who would come together and be bound together because you're the ecclesia of Athens. You're the ecclesia of Sparta. You're that gathering. And so what God does is he says, okay, you guys know what an ecclesia is? And they go, well, yeah, we know what that is. Okay, well, I want to use that idea to tell you about a new kind of ecclesia. Now, that's one small example, but it does seem to me that God intentionally uses these ubiquitous Greek ideas to help explain the gospel. And I just, looking back, think that is just awesome that God does things in that way.
Mm-hmm. Maybe the most prominent example in the New Testament of this is John's opening prologue. In the beginning was the Logos, which of course is a huge term in Greek philosophy to mean reason and the principle on which the world is governed and runs. And John says, and the Logos was God and became flesh and dwelt among us. And this is a powerful way of utilizing something that is the deliverance of the Greeks, who everybody would have known vaguely what he means by this term Logos, and then spin it to say, you know, that thing you guys know about, that's actually Jesus Christ. He is the principle upon which everything rests. He is the explanation and creator and wisdom of the universe. And the New Testament writers are doing this. This is the world that they live in. These are the waters they swim in. And they are Greek, very Greek waters, not to downplay the Jewishness of the gospel in the New Testament, but to emphasize the blend of the Hellenistic and Jewish world that we see in the New Testament.
Yeah, it's interesting to me that as we get closer to the New Testament, you can see how all these empires play their role. But at this point, Athens and its legacy certainly have paved the road to lead to Christ.
Well, one of the quotes that you put into our notes for this one is attributed to Alexander the Great. And it says, "I'm not afraid of an army of lions led by a sheep. I am afraid of an army of sheep led by a lion." And so we'll leave it with that quote as we approach the birth of a lion who is like a lamb, the Lion of Judah, who will be born into this Greco-Roman empire and change the world forever. Thanks for listening to the So We Speak podcast. If you like what you hear, go ahead and leave a comment, leave a review, email us, tell us what you like about it, tell us what you'd improve about it. Thanks to all you guys who are listening, and we'll see you next week on the So We Speak podcast.